Baseball Tonight, the podcast.
This is the Baseball Tonight podcast for Wednesday, July 1st, 2020. Producing from his home studio in the foothills of Connecticut is Taylor Schwenk. I'm Buster Olney, working from my home studio in New York. We got a lot to get to today. We're going to be speaking with June Lee of ESPN. I had a great article about the lack of diversity in front offices. We're going to be talking with Carl Ravitch about where baseball stands with its testing as we move forward. And we'll be talking with Paul Imbakides, maybe about partying, but probably about the MVP award and a question that popped up in a great story done by Ben Walker of the Associated Press. But before we get to that, some notes. Today is the first day when players are to officially report to their teams, and the testing continues amid a lot of speculation within the industry about where the numbers are going to be. We're going to be talking with Carl Ravitch about that. The Yankees are optimistic concerning the health of Aaron Judge and other star players. Given an extra 3.5 months for their brittle stars to heal, the Yankees will closely monitor the condition of Judge, James Paxton, Aaron Hicks, and Giancarlo Stanton ahead of the season. General Manager Brian Cashman said, "We want these players to withstand a 60-game sprint over a 66-game schedule." Really awful news yesterday, not unexpected. Baseball's minor leagues canceled their season Tuesday because of the coronavirus pandemic, and the head of their governing body, Pat O'Connor, told reporters that more than half of the 160 teams are in danger of failing without government assistance or private equity injections. The National Association of Professional Baseball Leagues, the minor league governing body, made the long-expected announcement. We're going to be talking with Hembo about that in just a second. But before that, if you've got an itch to watch live games, the basketball tournament is airing on ESPN starting July 4th. It's a 5-on-5 single elimination hoops tournament with a $1 million prize for the tournament champions. And you can get up to speed on all things TBT by listening to Courtside with Greenberg and Dokic. Seth and Dan are calling games and going all in on the basketball tournament, talking to the league's commissioner, coaches, and players on the show. You can find it wherever you get your podcasts.
Jumping into the numbers.
After evaluating millions of pieces of data in the blink of an eye, the winner is Cincinnati by 200 points. Why, you worthless hunk of junk.
This is Hembo Knows.
Hembo is Paul Imbakides, a researcher at ESPN who's the honcho, head honcho, he says, on the show Get Up. We've learned from Mike Greenberg it's because he's a wild partier through which Greeny can live vicariously. And Hembo, before your days as a wild partier and the head honcho of Get Up, you work for a minor league team, yes?
I did. I was an intern for the Reading Phillies, the Phillies AA affiliate, before my senior year of college.
So how did you feel about the news yesterday? Not only about the fact that this is not a surprise that there will not be minor league season this year, but the news from the head of the minor leagues that so many teams are in financial trouble.
Yeah, I mean, the news was unsurprising, but I would say the strength behind his quotes was what really struck me. I mean, he described the minor leagues as being in dire straits, Buster. And, you know, you read the report just as I did. He went as far as to suggest that half, if not more than half, of the minor league clubs aren't self-sustainable from a financial standpoint, having to, you know, sit out the rest of the season for lack of a better term. And that's what really saddened me. And as someone who's worked in a minor league baseball organization, what really strikes me, Buster, and what struck me even then before I even entered corporate America, was how much of a sort of mom and pop operation it was, for lack of a better term. And what those teams mean to those communities, it goes without saying, is extremely significant. And so many of these places, Buster, don't have Major League Baseball teams close by. So in a lot of ways, baseball is really a grassroots thing, and to go a full season without having minor league baseball, given the fact that there's the likelihood that this, we feel the ripple effects for several years, it's really going to change the complexion of the sport in ways that I think a lot of fans don't quite realize, that only watch the big leagues. But across the country, these teams are really popular all over the place. And I think a lot of these places, unfortunately, have to face a rude awakening now that we know for certain, at least, that we're not having a season.
You know, when I read stories like this, too, and you see that they're potentially in trouble, as you say, it's a ma and pa, organizations in some of these places. I feel like that it would be important for Major League Baseball to jump in with its financial power and to help prop up these teams. And that doesn't mean to, you know, that they have to just hand over a bunch of cash, but you hope that they work with them in terms of arranging loans, financing, that sort of thing to help keep these teams going.
I could not agree more. This is something I would describe as an existential threat. I think Major League Baseball from the top does need to offer some financial assistance, but also urge these organizations, these big league clubs, in the right direction from this standpoint too. And Buster, what makes this even more troubling to me is that we talked about it in December when Rob Manfred, for all intents and purposes, threatened to eliminate 25% of teams in the minor leagues to begin with. I think the number was 42 teams to eliminate when that happened. And of course, that was, you know, before the coronavirus took over. But these clubs, we're talking, he estimates 85 or 90% of their revenue is driven from in-stadium experience, because obviously the television money is not an option. Buster, baseball is so important to this country, and the minor league baseball structure we have is unique to baseball. It is the only thing like it in any of our sports today. It in so many ways shapes the way that people root for the game, in so many ways shapes the way that these players come up. And the idea of some of these organizations not being able, like, I understand, like, there are a lot of businesses that are not going to be able to make it through this, but a lot of those businesses don't have a behemoth of a corporation like Major League Baseball to potentially help them out. If subsidies of Amazon, for example, were really struggling right now, I'm sure Jeff Bezos would lend a helping hand. I think there are a lot of examples like that. I absolutely think the impetus is on Major League Baseball here, not to use this as an excuse to nix some of these teams like they wanted to do anyway. This is not the time to be doing that. This is a time in which baseball should be doing its best to grow from the bottom up. I think you agree. And anything they can do financially would help. And I think it should go without saying, Buster, that Major League Baseball, from a financial standpoint, can, without making much of a dent into its bottom line, go a long way in helping these clubs, because we're not talking about consequential amounts of money. And that's why some of these labor negotiations we discussed over the last month were so curious to me. In the grand scheme of it, Major League Baseball could go a long way in helping without really affecting its bottom line all that much.
Yeah, it was just last week that we got word from the Los Angeles Times that the Angels are in the beginning of a $2.5 billion remodeling around their ballpark. So you can't tell me that, you know, that these various teams, Major League Baseball doesn't have the ability to help these teams out. And again, we're not, neither Hembo or I are suggesting that they should just hand over a bunch of cash, but in terms of providing some financing to get them through, they absolutely, you know, have the power to do that. My friend Ben Walker, who works for the Associated Press, wrote a great story yesterday about the MVP award. And he noted in the story that the MVP award that's given out every year is named for Kennesaw Mountain Landis, who was the baseball commissioner right after the Black Sox scandal. And part of the reason why baseball didn't integrate until 1947 was because Kennesaw Mountain Landis was a segregationist. And his name is on the MVP award. And our former colleague, Barry Larkin, was asked about it by Ben. And Larkin said, "Why is it on there? I was always aware of his name and what that means to slowing the color line in Major League Baseball, of the racial injustice and inequality that black players had to go through." A lot of other former MVP winners are quoted in the story that Ben did. And I got to tell you, Hembo, when I read the story, I was like, oh, yeah, that's right. That is named for Kennesaw Mountain Landis. Boy, that's stupid.
It feels like one
of those things. It's an easy fix for the. And by the way, it's not Major League Baseball's award. It's the Baseball Writers Association. So you would assume there's going to be some kind of a Zoom call with a bunch of baseball writers saying, "Yeah, of course we're going to change that."
This is an easy one. I agree with you. Kennesaw Mountain Landis is best known for two things. Every baseball fan knows it. It's expunging the Black Sox, and it is being a segregationist. I think it's very clear and obvious based on his record. And Major League Baseball integrated 3 years after he was done. He sat atop the league for 23 years. He was gone for the third year he was gone. Branch Rickey, who had been in the game for a really, really long time, decided now was the time to integrate. I don't think that's a coincidence. But what I always ask myself is, when we have these sort of cultural debates, if we were starting this now, who would the MVP award be named after? It would obviously not be named after Kennesaw Mountain Landis, not just because of his sort of irrelevance towards the award, but also because of his, frankly, racist past. And I think objective people can go there. I do think there is real value in knowing and understanding the history of baseball and appreciating it, while at the same time not celebrating all the things that we shouldn't. And having an MVP award named after someone who held baseball back for decades from integrating, I think, is a really easy thing to decision to come to. And like you said, I think the writers will probably act quickly.
And on Twitter this morning, as I sent out a link to this story, a Twitter follower named Zach Malden gave the absolute perfect remedy for this situation in terms of naming the MVP award after. He said, name it after Frank Robinson, who, of course, won the award in both leagues. And I was
that's great.
Like that to me was notion. Like, it's over, done, conversation finished.
Yeah, I would second that motion. That's an easy one. Another easy one. Frank Robinson also managed in both leagues. Buster, I think, like, obviously we are experiencing a reckoning of sorts in this country right now. And I think baseball has done an outstanding job, it seems, over the last couple months in sort of rallying behind its players. They've been very active on social media and all the rest of it. But this is an easy one. Frank Robinson, of course, you know, nobody loves him more than our buddy Tim Kirkham, but he is a behemoth in this game. And having won the award in both leagues and having, of course, been around the game for like 60 years and have been a huge part of both leagues, both as a player and as a manager, that's an easy one. That's a fun one. And I'll tip my cap to Zach or whoever you said it was on Twitter, because I wish I had thought of it.
I know, exactly. And by the way, you saw you last one for you. You said the Kennesaw Mount Landis is remembered for two things, the Black Sox scandal and being inter segregationist. There's actually a third thing he should be remembered for. Hembo, it was Kennesaw Mount Landis who created the character clause language for the Hall of Fame voting, which has so much irony to it.
Yeah, no kidding. That is rich. That is rich. I mean, look, the retroactive morality that we do know is sometimes challenging because they're living in a different time. But look, like, this is clear as day. This is clear as day right now. Like, Kennesaw Mountain Landis, who, yeah, like you said, not only held baseball back for so long, but created a clause that he himself has clearly broken, and he's a member of the Hall of Fame. It's certainly ironic, to say the least.
Exactly. All right, Hembo, thank you.
Later, boy.
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences, so the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of the show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Buster. Just go to Indeed.com/Buster right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/Buster. Terms and conditions apply. You can now stream the most MLB games on DirecTV without a satellite dish.
Yes. The clutch hits, the strikeouts, grand salamis, web gems, with nothing on your roof. So whoever's up there, whether it's roofers, Santa, birds, old-timey chimney sweeps, moody teenagers, thrill-seeking raccoons, you name it, they won't find a satellite dish. But you will find your MLB games on DirecTV. That means DirecTV is your home for baseball this season. Root, 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 with nothing on your roof. Call 1-800-DIRECTV or visit DirecTV.com. Sign up today. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package.
All aboard! It's the Rabbit Train with Carl Ravitch.
The Rabbit Train, Carl Ravitch. Rabbit, how you doing? You getting this early morning KBO schedule?
Awesome. We had a walk-off today. It's classic. When we've done this for 10 weeks now. You actually get to know the personalities, players. There's a team there. So similar to the Orioles that got off to that awful start years ago. This Hanwha Eagles team, Buster, you watch them and you can kind of see, I think you used a great analogy during the KBO game on Tuesday about launching a tiny sailboat into a sea when you know that there is a storm 3 miles away. In this case, the poor Hanwha Eagles, Buster, they are 12 wins and like 39 losses. They lost again on a walk-off hit. You could see them imploding. Their bullpen's a disaster. And Matt Williams, who leads the Kia Tigers, got another victory today, their first walk-off victory. So teams have personalities, and already, you know, we're 9 weeks into it. We're going to have a 60-game major league season. We've learned a lot, and they've played about 50 games, 51 games. You definitely, in that short period of time, can learn about a team, and they will develop trends and habits, and that will apply to Major League Baseball once we get going. So yeah. The hours are fine. It's baseball. The people are great. We've really enjoyed it.
Yeah, you guys have done so many great interviews. I love the one you had last week with a former pitcher from the Phillies. Breaking news on during the broadcast. That was something.
Yes. It was pretty incredible. Yeah, he told us about his wife who is pregnant at risk. So she and her son who are with him have to fly back. And he, I think he tears. Yeah, I mean, whether it be the foreign-born players and more importantly, the folks that live in Korea, their willingness to be on and be vulnerable and sheer joy has been, I'll be honest, very frightening given the stuff that we, deal with regards to Major League Baseball and certainly this latest negotiation. It is so refreshing and incredible. It's been great.
Yeah, that player, David Buchanan, the pitcher who told you that live on air. You know, my early sense is that we're not necessarily, it's not guaranteed that we're going to get, that level of cooperation from teams. I really hope that's wrong, Carl. Like, if there's a time when baseball needs everyone to be all in on the coverage and humanizing the players, this would be the year.
You know, you have owners over there that are large conglomerates, but what they do is they allow their fans to bring food to the ballpark, to bring their own drinks to the ballpark. They charge $8 a ticket at the low end and maybe 30, 40 at the high end. We had guys who host a KBO Grand Slam podcast that had come to like South Africa and Ireland and live in South Korea now. They talked about the affordability. They talked about the experience at a ballpark. I all about Major League Baseball owners and the business and the money that you want to make. But regards to access and things like that, like there is such a different way to do business. Whether you're a player willing to grant an interview, there is an absolute distinction between talking to those guys over there and the people in and around the game who never make you feel like they feel like you're trying to get something, to sneak something by them, to take advantage of them. Which none of us are trying to do. We're trying to improve the quality as for the viewer at home. In the case of Major League Baseball, it seems and feels like every time you're asking a question, you're making a request to take the firstborn of some player. Like it's just a little bit over the top where we're trying to help. We're trying to expose you, grow your brand, let people see you. And it strikes me, somebody like Adam Wainwright, who's so good, and when he came on was so great, it only enhances Adam Wainwright's, perception out there, and it should be as it is, great, because he was great. That's how every player over there has been, and you're right. I hope it changes. I'm skeptical, but it does make you feel like, you're after something when you're not. You're after an interview. You'd like to talk to them. You'd like to share their story. You'd like to have their personalities exposed. You don't have to talk about whether you threw a 3-2 curveball or why you laid off that pitch as a hitter. Like, let's get to know you a little bit. I hope they've learned that from the microphones they've worn in spring training. I'd love to think that they will see some of this or their own experiences in spring and take it to the next level. But I'm skeptical. I don't know why there's such an antagonistic attitude between the players and owners and sometimes between the media and the players, or at least the the folks in the PR departments. I don't get it.
No, and that needs to change this year, like as soon as possible. You're right. You made reference to All Access Week that we had on ESPN, the microphones with Anthony Rizzo and Chris Bryant and Dominic Smith and Freddie Freeman.
Freddie Freeman.
It was so good. And I know that that was a point of negotiation between the two sides and it wasn't resolved. I really hope on the player's side that they just say, you know what? This year we're going to do it because we need to do it. We'll just have to wait and see how it plays out. Real quick, I want to ask you about the story that came out yesterday from Ben Walker of the Associated Press about the Kennesaw Mountain Landis Award, otherwise known as the MVP Award. You know, what was interesting is when I read this, I thought, I don't even think of it as the Kennesaw Mountain Landis Award.
No one does.
Not like the Lombardi Trophy we always refer to as the Super Bowl. I had forgotten that it was named for him, and so – two quick things. One, the conference call with the baseball writers who own the award should be 2 seconds long. Everyone says, yes, we're going to change it. And two, as one of our Twitter followers suggested this morning, put Frank Robinson's name on it, someone who won the award in both leagues.
That's a simple one. And, I know we have a Roberto Clemente Award. My mind went to Clemente first, then it went to Hank Aaron. There were a lot of statements that can be made. Certainly Frank Robinson is absolutely worthy of having the MVP award named after him. But you're right. This is not an award that you associate with the name in front of the three letters. The three letters are what matter. Did you win the MVP award? I've never in my life heard anyone refer to it as the Kennesaw Mountain Landis Trophy. Never in my life. And, you know, we've been involved with baseball for 30 years, 25 intimately with Major League Baseball. I've never once heard it referred to as that. I do think that if you renamed it and it becomes the Frank Robinson MVP award, I think it would have legs. I think it would actually change the way that people address it. But in the end, it's still going to defer to MVP. That's what the trophy is.
Exactly. All right. I think you'd agree with me, just talking with folks around baseball, there is a lot of anticipation for these first numbers that we're going to get, we hopefully get, from Major League Baseball and the Players Association about the coronavirus. What are you hearing? Because I feel like this is going to be an absolute crossroad determined by what these numbers are. What do you think?
You know, we're trying to put a blanket over something that literally requires to consider every stitch. In a sense, I mean, this is such an individual response. I think you're going to have players, families who look at the numbers, which clearly are going to show positive cases, and say, look, historically, as short as the history has been, our age group, our physical activity, our strength, et cetera, we are not necessarily immune from it, but perhaps we are far more immune to the effects of it. And then you're going to have others who are certainly going to say, I'm not putting myself or my family at risk. I could be the exceptions to the rules that it doesn't dramatically impact me physically. So again, there are stitches in a blanket and everyone needs to be respected and needs to be considered. I'm leaning towards the idea, Buster, that barring some unforeseen number, I'm assuming that somewhere between 3 and 7% of the people tested would come back positive and a smaller number would show symptoms. I go back to Cam Champ, who was here with the PGA Tour in Hartford, who was shocked when he found out that he tested positive. He had no symptoms and claimed to feel great. You'll get some of those. And I think that it's not going to be a deterrent to bringing the game back if the numbers are within that particular, 3 to 7% test, because that's what it is universally. How is it going to be any more or less if you're sort of broad basing the group? So I don't think it's a game changer. I think if the numbers are higher aberrationally, I can certainly see the commissioner saying, "Oh, whoa, we actually have a bigger problem than the rest of the country, or we are currently in a hotspot." To me, the issue is going to be when you're traveling to currently a place like Miami, a place like Houston, a place like Dallas, those states, that becomes where is our alternative site? Where is the location we take, using as an example, the Miami, where do we take them and put them so that their home field becomes X, whether it's Nashville, Tennessee, or Omaha, Nebraska? Where do they go so that you don't have to bring an entire team into an area that's currently on fire with the virus? That's the, to me, the bigger question for a Major League Baseball to answer, as opposed to we've had 4% of the players test positive, we're quarantining them, and hopefully they're back in 2 weeks and feel great.
So you think the shifting landscape of which municipality states are open, which one are closed, and the difficulty of trying to navigate around the logistics of that?
I think you run into a whole hell of a lot of questions if the local or state officials grant some type of waiver for the baseball team to go into that area, and then, God forbid, a number of players contract a virus based on a waiver or based on some leeway that was granted to the team because they wanted to play the games at Park X. I think you got to, I personally would hope you would avoid that. We're moving the home team to a safer environment. We're trying to reduce the risk. Bringing a team into an area that's a hotbed for the virus, to me, doesn't make sense if you have alternatives. And I would think that you would have alternatives.
I got to say, too, Carl, that I've sort of cringed at the flip side of that that question, too. If I were, for example, a resident in the city of Toronto, and I read in the paper this morning that the Toronto Blue Jays got a special waiver to have this, you know, traveling band of 80 players and staff not have to adhere to the federal mm-hmm. mandate that was laid down. And there was no assuredness that nothing assured that the players would be locked down. It's not like the Blue Jays players are going to be put into a baseball camp and not allowed to leave. Like, players can leave. If I were a resident of Toronto, that would kind of make me mad. Like, why is it that with the coronavirus, why is a baseball player have different rights than anybody else?
Yeah, that's why I would hope that they wouldn't go down the road of trying to find ways around the local or state governments to grant waivers. Like, the goal isn't to bring people into a city that's on fire, let alone bringing people into a city where the residents may be concerned about those that are coming in. To me, that would be off limits. Because of the nature of the decision makers and how they feel about the virus, in spite of an outbreak, you may still have a governor or a mayor saying, nope, we're carrying on. We're going through this in spite of this outbreak. And you subsequently then have to make a decision as an individual, perhaps as a team, although I think this is, I'm not going to that particular, I'm not going to go play there. You know, I'll go there and there, and but I'm not going to go there because look at what's going on. And I have an immune system that's compromised or a family member who I can't risk. So in the case of just using Toronto, I'm not going to Toronto if that were a hotbed. Whatever that hotbed is, I'm taking that series off. That may be another direction this goes, but I would think there are alternatives. And I guess to play devil's advocate, like you just did, let's just use Omaha, Nebraska as a place where if I'm in Omaha, I don't want people that wouldn't otherwise be here coming to my city to play a baseball game that I can't go watch. There are blades on both sides of the sword for sure.
You and I talked about, and Eduardo talked about on the KBO broadcast yesterday, about the idea of transparency. I'm hearing this from a lot of players about the need for transparency whenever these numbers come out. Joel Sherman of the New York Post wrote yesterday that they're still in discussions about transparency, about the information. I think it's pretty clear that the teams are not going to announce the names of individual players who test positive. Carl, I think it's absolutely essential for everybody involved, as well as the public, that Major League Baseball and the Player Association release the numbers and percentages, because this is the information that the players and the staffers are going to base their decisions on. You're right. It's very possible that later in the week we find out that, say, 3% of the players test positive, and that would be taken as good news for the players. And on the other hand, if you got an aberrational number like 15%, that's going to inform decisions by the players. I think they are owed that right to get those numbers. What do you think?
Yeah, I think the distinction between names and numbers is critical. I don't think anybody's name, various laws will prevent that. But sure, I think you do need to know. If I'm, in a public sense, going into a town where you know that the infection rate is a particular number, you're less likely to go. In this case, you know the body of number of testing. You know you're testing the 60 players. If 30 of them get a 50% rate, we know that. This is different than like getting on an airplane and necessarily knowing who in the airplane is tested positive. Although you could certainly make the argument that before you get on a plane, you want to know that too in a public sense. But here you have a controlled environment. You know the 60 people or 80 or 100, whatever the organization is you're testing. That has to be transparent because you're forcing somebody. You're not voluntarily getting on an airplane. You're forcing somebody, in a sense, to go play. And if they have legitimate excuses and reasons not to, you're not. But otherwise, you're on the plane with the rest of the team, and we're going to, again, I keep using Toronto. I don't want to because it sounds like I know something I don't. I don't want to go to Miami because we know that they are literally in the middle of an outbreak. And there's X amount, and now you're telling me that 14 Miami Marlins tested positive. No, I'm out. I don't want to be involved with that. So, yes, I think transparency is absolutely critical and has to be a part of this. I don't know. I don't really understand why it wouldn't be.
I know.
I don't get that.
I don't either. And I keep on waiting for at some point. I think it's beholden on the leaders on both sides to just come out and say, no, of course we're doing transparency. That's what we owe all these people who are involved in this effort to have baseball in 2020. Real quick before you go, I'll give you the same question I get asked all the time. Give me the percentages in your mind that we get through the summer camp and they start the season. And then what percentage would you attach the odds that we actually get through the World Series?
It moves sort of daily. I think that there is an absolute 100% dedicated effort to do this. I really do. I think deterring it is going to be very difficult. Derailing it is going to be very difficult. I think there's an acceptance level of a certain percentage of tests that are going to come back positive. I think I'm somewhere between 70 and 80% that this is going to start. Finishing it is just so unpredictable because clearly this is a virus that we have no idea the direction it goes in. It doesn't appear as if there's going to be a vaccine prior to what would be a World Series in October. Maybe medical miracles occur and they find one and somehow Major League Baseball is able to get its hands on enough doses. But, I would say that I'm more optimistic that it starts than it finishes. But it's impossible to predict that because this virus has proven impossible to get our hands and heads around with regards to slowing it or stopping it, let alone eliminating it.
You're 100% right. You know, a month ago, nobody would have predicted that we would have record numbers in the way that we have over the last week or so, or that Dr. Anthony Fauci would be testifying in front of Congress yesterday saying that it's possible we're going to have 100,000 positive tests per day in this country at the current trajectory. So you just don't know. Carl, thanks for doing this. Good to talk with you again.
Okay, Buster. Anytime.
For the ones who get it done, Grainger offers high-quality supplies and solutions for every industry, as well as access to product specialists who have the knowledge and experience to answer your toughest questions. Plus, their commitment to being your safety partner can help you keep your facilities safe and your people safer. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by.
Vivid Seats wants to get you to the games you love this spring. Experience every pitch, assist, and game-winning shot live and in person. And the best part? Each transaction is a step toward a free 11 ticket with Vivid Seats rewards. Score unbeatable perks like free tickets, surprise seat upgrades, and annual birthday deals. As the official ticketing partner of ESPN, Vivid Seats is offering you $20 off your first $200 ticket purchase with code BASEBALL. That's code baseball. Visit VividSeats.com or download the app today. Vivid Seats. Experience it live.
June Lee covers baseball for ESPN. And June, you know, on the eve of the story that you posted yesterday about the lack of diversity in Major League Baseball's front offices, Ian Desmond sent out a post in announcing that he was not going to participate in the 2020 season, which, you know, was the punchline to his whole nine-page Instagram post. But so much of it was about the lack of diversity in baseball. And I'm guessing that as you read that, you were just nodding your head like, yep, he just put it on a tee for me when my story posts in the morning.
100%. I mean, this is a conversation that I've been having, not just with, you know, people in the front office, people who are work on the field, but it's also a conversation that you have with players where you feel kind of this disconnect between the front offices and the players because there's kind of this growing cultural gap. You know, I kind of outlined in my story and how the influx of Ivy Leaguers into Major League Baseball over the course of the last two decades, it's kind of brought this Wall Street culture to the sport where the front offices, or the vast majority of front offices, I think, in the sport today, treat players more like financial assets more than anything. And so there's kind of this degradation of the personal relationship between the front office, I think, that's happened, and the player. And I have to believe that is partially at least contributed to kind of the labor tension that we've seen over the course of this entire pandemic. But it's kind of emblematic of the larger systemic issues of baseball. I think largely being kind of apathetic or not really putting in any effort to kind of solve its diversity problems from the ground up. You know, I've talked about the C-League rule in the story, and a lot of the minorities that I talk to around the game talk about how, like the Rooney rule in the NFL, it kind of makes them feel a little bit tokenized. And really the root of the problem is the entry-level jobs, how the game today kind of values people who program, you know, can type in, who can program in R and Python. And so these front offices are kind of hyper-focused on those as the job candidates, and those are the guys, you know, eventually in 10, 15 years are going to be rising up to lead these baseball teams. So it's kind of a culture that kind of perpetuates itself on to a large extent. And I think Ian Desmond kind of touched on a lot of the cultural ramifications of that within his Instagram post.
And I want to get to contributing to the labor tension, because I totally agree with you. And as I was reading your piece, some of these thoughts were going through my mind. We'll get to that in a second. As you were doing your research, what were some of the numbers that jumped out at you the most? And your story has a lot of those statistics.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, so something that I think everyone around the game has felt is just seeing the influx of Ivy Leaguers. But to actually kind of look at the hard numbers was definitely eye-opening for me.
June, if I can interrupt for a second, I think two things really fueled that, the success of Theo Epstein and the book Moneyball. Yes.
Yes, 100%. I mean, I would say that the hiring of Theo Epstein kind of validated this idea that you can go out and hire a young Ivy Leaguer and it makes sense. And, you know, the first couple of hires, it was John Daniels and Andrew Friedman. Those two have largely worked out, right? You know, John Daniels is still in Texas and Andrew Friedman runs the Dodgers now after having a lot of success in Tampa Bay. You know, so I think this was a feeling that a lot of people have had. Wow, there's a lot of Ivy Leaguers in the game now. But, you know, in spring training back in February, which seems like an eternity ago, I kind of put together this spreadsheet and was just kind of inputting all the alma maters for the people who run baseball ops over the course of the last two decades. And so when you look at the numbers and it's staring at you right in the face, you know, in 2001, 3% of teams are run by Ivy Leaguers. It was literally only Sandy Alderson, who's a Dartmouth grad. And today it's 43%. And that's a massive jump over the course of two decades. And beyond that, just beyond the Ivy League, if you look at kind of the traditional prestigious colleges, you know, U.S. News top 25 universities or liberal arts colleges, the percentage of people running those teams who graduate from those colleges has risen from 24% in 2001 to 67% in 2020. And we've kind of seen a coincident drop of former players running teams at the same time. And being a former player was kind of the gateway for a lot of minorities to run teams. And that kind of pathway is starting to dry up currently, given the current hiring landscape of baseball executives.
As you were doing your reporting and you were presenting those numbers that you dug out to folks you talked to, what was the reaction that you got?
It was honestly uniformly the same, where everyone was like, this does surprise me. And when I kind of asked the same questions, the same answers kept coming up, you know, across organizations, across AL, NL, men, women, minorities, you know, even white executives. You know, there was a lot of people who kind of acknowledge like all of these things are happening, these conversations are happening, but nobody's kind of doing anything about it. And so what I kind of wanted to do with the piece was kind of put it all out there and kind of show how all of these issues are kind of interconnected. You know, the fact that, you know, baseball, a lot of the entry level jobs are low paying. And so it requires someone, often requires someone who has kind of a financial backing from their family to kind of go in it. And that obviously limits the pool. And that's directly tied into, you know, the cost of the Ivy League. You know, over the course of the last two decades, you know, the average tuition cost for the alma maters of people running baseball ops departments has risen more than $20,000. It's kind of a multifold problem. It's not just a racial problem, which I think Ken Williams told USA Today earlier this year. It's kind of a multifold problem where there's you know, a classist problem, and then there's also you know, baseball is kind of focusing on a very specific group of Ivy Leaguers as well. The 2019 graduating class of Harvard was majority minority, and you know, most of the graduates who are coming into baseball are white men. And I think that that kind of is emblematic of the larger systemic problems that is kind of permeates all of baseball's hiring practices, which I, you know, what, in the feedback that I got from executives yesterday, you know, people who run front offices to the commissioner's office, everyone acknowledged like this is a problem that's happening in baseball.
Yeah. And I felt like in reading your story that when we talk about systemic problem, that starts with the owners. You know, Theo Epstein recently talked about how he's, you know, in his own mind, he has to do better. Than when he looks back at the people he's hired, too many of them, in his opinion, look like him. I think that that's something that owners have to look at. I think they've hired a lot of people who look like them, for lack of a better way to describe it, and have similar backgrounds to theirs.
Yeah, I 100% agree with you. This is an organizational issue. This is not just, you know, Theo Epstein obviously has a lot of power within the Cubs organization, and he's got a very, very powerful voice within the sport of baseball. But ultimately, this stems back to the people who pay the people to run their teams in the first place. It comes back to the way that owners hire their general managers, people who run their team, and that kind of mindset kind of trickles on down to the rest of the organization. And so it is imperative upon the owners to at least start thinking about this a lot more, thinking about why this problem has arisen, and also why, you know, I think it's kind of emblematic of, in many ways, I think personally as a young person, of the way that the game has been covered over the course of the last, you know, 10 to 20 years. I think there's been a much heavier emphasis on analytics writing, on treating, you know, players like financial assets. And I think there is a lot of value on that as someone who loves numbers. But I think there also has been a kind of a de-emphasis on storytelling throughout the course of baseball. And I think it's not a coincidence that baseball is having a harder time marketing its players currently when the organizations themselves are treating the players like financial assets more so than, you know, this idealistic romantic idea of what we want baseball and sports to be as kind of a community service to a certain degree.
And just to get back to what you were saying about this contributing to labor tension, I completely agree with you. A few weeks ago, I wrote a column about how baseball has been, for lack of a better way, has been overrun by the Jeff Luhnow thinking. Him being an example because he had success initially before he was suspended from baseball. He goes to the Astros and they don't just tank, which, you know, I mean, let's face it, it happened to some degree in all sports, but he tanked to the extreme degree. You know, he participated, as a lot of these teams have increasingly, in service time manipulation. All of those things in the treating the players like assets, I agree with you, fueled the suspicion and the distrust that we saw in the recent labor talks.
Right. So whenever I talk to players, even before this pandemic happened, just about the state of the relationship and the, you know, before the pandemic happened, the CBA that was coming up, you know, this was a topic that continually came up with the players, was that they felt like they were treated like assets and not people. And I think, Buster, you can speak to this better than, you know, anybody at ESPN, just about how much baseball is a copycat league. And so owners see the success of the Astros. They win a World Series. Obviously, that has been marred by the trash can bang scandal. But, you know, you see Luhnow tank to the extremest of degrees. And then within a couple of years, you saw other teams taking almost the exact same building strategy, you know, building through the draft, trying to get high draft picks and rebuild that way. And, you know, I guess we'll see over the course of the next couple of years whether or not those strategies pay off and whether or not this remains a trend that continues throughout the course of baseball, whether we see kind of another pendulum swing, because we saw former players running team for a really, really long time. And I think people realize, you know, foreign players have biases in this way. And there was this market inefficiency for a long time to bring in the analytics guy to kind of balance things out. And I think the pendulum again has swung the complete opposite direction, where there might be a market inefficiency now with scouting and kind of having that on the field experience and what that brings to a front office to a certain degree, just having different perspectives in there.
And I guarantee you, last one for you, I guarantee you that when you're doing the reporting on this and you brought up the idea that so many of these front offices now are analytically driven and driven by these a lot of these Ivy Leaguers, that the product, generally speaking, has worsened, that people feel like our game is really boring right now in the way that it's evolved, driven by numbers. Yes.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I agree with that. And I think, you know, part of that, what stems into that is when you're treating players like financial assets, it's a lot harder for the fans to invest in a player and develop a relationship with that player, right? I think, you know, fans love stories. It's part of why we love sports is kind of hanging onto these narratives. And I think over the course of the 2000s, you saw a lot of those narratives kind of pop up in baseball. I think we've kind of seen a lot of those narratives kind of subside because the emphasis on the players has really, really shifted towards the front office. A lot of the fans, I think I've noticed over the course of the last decade, fans tend to take the side of the front office over the players. And I think that dynamic might be shifting, as we've seen over the course of the negotiations to come back during the pandemic. But I think that mindset where players are treated like financial assets not only kind of has permeated all the front offices, but has kind of seeped into the media and to the fans' perspective of the game as well over the course of the last decade.
All right, June, I appreciate it. Nice job with this.
Thanks, Buster. Really appreciate it.
Bleacher Tweets.
All righty, Buster. Bleacher Tweets for Wednesday. Before we get to that, though, happy Bobby Bonilla Day, Buster. Big day.
Is it?
Yeah.
I know a lot of people are excited. I've never been that excited about it because I feel like that, you know, for a lot of teams, they don't mind deferring salary. They like that. That's a good thing. And it's always been sort of held over the Mets as a big failure that they made this deal. I got to say, just in terms of financial structuring, a lot of teams would like to have Bobby Bonilla type days.
Oh,
what do
yeah.
you think?
I agree. I don't think it's a bad thing at all. And I think actually he's a savvy guy for setting this up. I mean, he's getting paid $1 million plus dollars until 2035. That's amazing. I love that deal.
Yeah, I covered Bobby Bo with the Orioles in 95, 96. I've always enjoyed talking with him. He now works for the Players Association. But I agree with you. You know, I always get worried about players and managing their finances. And, you know, is it something that's going to be an issue in retirement? Bobby Bo, he took care of it. Like every year to get that check. That's awesome for him.
Oh, he feels so good looking at his checking account this morning. Good stuff. Let's go to the tweets. Scott Mixon at ScottMix86 writes in, I feel like no one is giving the Braves a chance in this shortened season, even with their loaded bullpen. Why is that? What do you think about the Braves?
Scott, I'm not sure where you're seeing that no one's giving them a chance. I think they absolutely have a chance. I like the Nationals are defending champions, so people are going to talk about them as well. The Mets look dangerous. The Phillies probably will be better than they were last year. But yeah, the Braves are better since they improved their bullpen at the trade deadline last year.
Last one for today. Steve Miller at Steve.Miller writes in, don't you think starting pitching could actually be more important than what everyone thinks right now? Yes, right-handed pitching will be very valuable, but relief pitching will be very valuable. But starting pitchers that can get deep into games every start and only have to do that 10 or 11 times will be huge instead of 30 plus. We have been hanging on the importance of relievers, but what do you think about Steve's idea here?
Steve, I disagree with you because of the math. The fact is, what we've heard from managers is that starting pitchers will not be ramped up to midseason form probably for 3 to 4 weeks. So it'll take about a third of the season or almost half the season to get the starting pitchers, you know, back to regular form. And that's why relief pitchers, because they're going to be accounting for a larger share of the innings thrown, they're going to be more important. There could potentially, let's say a starting pitcher makes 10, 12 starts and he wins 10 of those. Yeah, we're going to be talking about that guy for the Cy Young Award.
Thanks for writing in, everyone. Hashtag Bleacher Tweets on Twitter. Please subscribe, rate, and review to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. And another soft pod promo here, ESPN Daily. A little bit of baseball talk on there. Friends of the pod, Jesse Rogers and June Lee on there today. Check it out.
All right, that's it for today. My thanks to Ravi, to June, to Hembo, and to Taylor. Have a great day, everybody. Thanks for listening. Stay safe. And remember, hate and inequality based on skin color is something we must attack every day.
Thanks for listening to the Baseball Tonight podcast. If you're playing fantasy baseball, don't forget to listen to the Fantasy Focus podcast. Check out all podcasts at ESPN.com/podcenter. Baseball Tonight, the podcast.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this? A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package. Terms and restrictions apply.